Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 7 of Retail Ramblings. We're going to continue on having an in-depth look at retail at this particular episode. But before we do so, just want to go back through what we covered on our last episode. So with our winners and losers on the DIY or home improvement side, we had a look at some brands rallying behind the people afflicted by the hurricanes in North America, particularly in the southern part of North America, and brands like the Home Depot are really going out of the way to help those who had been personally affected by those hurricanes. On the loser, we did have the Home Depot as well for having to pay a civil penalty of $5.7 million for selling recalled products.
And on the cosmetic side of things, we took a look at a winner, including Rihanna's launch of her brand Fenty Beauty. Some really exciting stuff going on with that brand, and I don't think that launch could have gone any better than it did. And on the loser side of things, we had L'Oreal. They had an impeding court case around some stolen formulas and something to do with monks. Really interesting section of the podcast there.
Yeah, it definitely was. That was a fun one to present. On the retail roadmap side of things, we had experiential in retail. And the importance of retail is creating a branded experience when consumers step in store, and how important that's becoming, considering the growth of omnichannel and making sure that brands align with both their in-store and online strategies.
And on the data dive, we took a look at the trend of natural and organic brands and how some big companies in the industry, such as Unilever and Nestle and P&G, as well, are doing to adapt to that change. We looked at a couple acquisitions that happened there and what these acquisitions mean in terms of using data.
Yeah, perfect. So without further ado, let's get into this week's winners and losers. So we're into our winners and losers for this week. Now, I do want to stress that we won't necessarily be looking directly at home improvement brands and retailers and cosmetics retailers and brands in isolation anymore, just because we want to really get a wider look at retail in general, and that's the kind of feedback that we've received. So we're going to be encompassing a few more brands and a few more retailers in our conversations with the winners and losers, still with a bit of a focus on the home improvement and cosmetics industry to make sure that we really cover everything. So I'm going to start with our first winner for the week. And this one actually kind of spans a bit of both, Marcia. So it's a bit of cosmetics, a bit of home improvement. And it's the brand Henkel, who have actually won a RAF Cycle Award. Now, RAF Cycle Awards are presented in recognition of excellence in recycling and environmental performance. And they're presented by UPM Raflatec. Now, UPM Raflatec have awarded this to Henkel for its commitment to improving the environmental performance of its self-adhesive labeling. Now, these are self-adhesive labels for their cosmetics products primarily. And what the reward was for was in relation to the byproduct of creating self-adhesive labeling. So in a little bit more depth, and I'm no scientist myself, but basically what happens when Henkel produces these self-adhesive labelings, there's a whole heap of industrial waste, and that's primarily siliconized glassine label liner, which would generally just go to the tip, right? Now, what's happening with this relationship between UPM Raflatec is UPM collects the used label from Henkel and recycles it into new graphic printing paper for books and magazines at their headquarters, or their paper mill, sorry, in Germany. Now, the reason that I found this so interesting and the reason that I've pointed them out as a winner for this particular episode is the importance of sustainability. And it's not like this is a new trend. And I don't know, Marcia, if you've seen this come through more recently or be more prominent recently. We've definitely seen it on the cosmetic side for brands to be sustainable.
Yeah, I've seen it on really across all kinds of industries. And actually, back in the days when I was working at Jarden, one of the brands that I was working on was First Alert. And even there, you guys are probably familiar, First Alert as fire alarms and smoke detectors and really like life safety stuff. We actually had a SKU of a product that specifically catered to this. It was an environmentally focused product where the box was made out of recycled materials, and we had special bins set up in stores like the Home Depot and Lowe's to be able to collect used fire detectors and the packaging that came with it.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. And the reason that I wanted to point Henkel out as a winner is it's difficult for brands to balance the relationship between being sustainable and also being operationally effective and being profitable. So there was another article that I actually picked up in the news this week, and it was Walmart doing much of the same thing in trying to be sustainable and setting a target for 2022 to reduce harmful chemicals in products. And they're generally a leader in this space. They obviously have an organization that is dedicated to being sustainable in the long term. And they've basically set a target to reduce harmful chemicals in cosmetics, beauty, baby, and household cleaning products by 10% by 2022. But something else that I noticed during the week was Honest Cleaning Company. Now, Honest Cleaning Company obviously have a name that is indicative of the product that they serve, but they haven't necessarily been sustainable. And that's where it kind of this RAF Cycle Award was really interesting to me, because it's so difficult for brands to tread this fine line. The Honest Company had a massive PR failure when they said that their products didn't include a chemical called sodium lauryl sulfate, SLS, it's better known as within the industry. And it was included as part of their laundry detergent, but they were adamant that they didn't have it as part of their laundry detergent, part of the ingredients. And then once it was recognized and actually tested, they continued to deny its presence and its importance or its negative impacts as a product. So again, it begs the questions, is it possible for brands to be sustainable and profitable? Where is the line for a brand to be sustainable and profitable? And how much is it up for governments as well to regulate these brands? There's quite a lot to it. But I guess Henkel's obviously found a really nice balance, and they've been duly awarded for the balance that they've been able to find.
That's really great. I mean, yeah, like these are questions that I'm sure a lot of brands are thinking about, and it will be really interesting to keep this brand front of mind and keep monitoring them and see if they remain a winner. But from what you've shared with us so far, I don't see why they can't be sustainable and profitable. And it really seems like that's where the industry is going across different categories. So I think now more than ever, it is really possible for brands to be doing both.
Yeah, definitely. And who have you got on your side for a winner this week, Marsha?
So I'm really excited about this week's winner. It's actually one of my favorite retailers. So Forever 21 is actually expanding into cosmetics. It was really interesting for me to find out. And they're doing this with a store called Riley Rose. And they're opening a dozen stores, and the first one is slated to open in California. So what I found really interesting about this is that this store was actually conceived by Linda and Esther Chang, who are the daughters of Forever 21's founders. So the two of them have both been involved in the marketing and visual merchandising at Forever 21 for a number of years. But they both felt that something was missing in beauty, that's a bold statement to make, given, you know, there's brands like Sephora out there, Ulta, sure. You know, what's missing in the market?
It basically makes our podcast kind of redundant, doesn't it? But yeah.
But you know what? These two ladies felt like there was a hole in the market for a beauty and lifestyle brand that catered to their generation, which is millennials, as well as Gen Z. So they kind of decided, you know what, let's try this. So what they're doing differently is that they're aiming to offer a variety of products besides beauty. So these Riley Rose stores will also have things like a candy section, a section for small housewares, stationery, and small accessories like socks and phone covers. And these are the point of this is to prompt discovery of new brands. So right now the stores are carrying approximately 200 brands. And about 80 of them are beauty, which is really interesting for a beauty store that out of 200, less than half are actually beauty.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So the way that they're merchandising this is their vision is to really rotate in and out based on the popularity and to provide constant discovery opportunities for customers. So the collection of the beauty brands that they're going to carry is described as quirky, with a lot of indies in the mix. So this is almost similar to Sephora in some ways. I know that Sephora loves to bring in some interesting independent sort of brands. But this Forever 21 endeavor is going to be doing something similar. And the prices are, there's kind of a big range. So there's things like sheet masks starting from $3, which is super affordable. And the prices will go up to around $50, which is obviously still a lot cheaper than what you'd find in Sephora and in Ulta. Some of the brands that they're going to carry is K-Beauty, There's Misha Gudal, Thank You Farmer. I'm not sure if I'm saying all of these correctly, but those are some big names in the industry. And on the hair section, they're including things like Living Proof, which is a big brand, and R&Co. The other thing that I found super interesting about Riley Rose is that they're making the whole focus of the look of the store to be really Instagram friendly, which makes so much sense when you're thinking about their target, which is millennials and Gen Z. So, for example, they have things like a tub full of bath bombs. They also have a selfie wall that's like in pink neon. And if you tag Riley Rose, your images actually show up on a live feed on giant screens within the stores.
Crazy.
I mean, I could just see my like 13-year-old self going into one of these stores even now. Like, I mean, for sure I would be in that.
Yeah.
In that bathtub taking that selfie. That sounds really fun. So, yeah, super cool. Makes a lot of sense with what we've been saying about social and beauty brands. And lastly, the thing that I want to point out is that they're doing something interesting with their merchandising in terms of in-store and online. And it's a little bit different than what Sephora is doing. So their full assortment that you can find in stores are not going to be all available online once their site goes live. And the reason for that is that the company wants to encourage people to come to the stores. They want people to come in and to really have that experience of playing in the store. So what they're going to be doing is really using data to make sure that they're having the right products in store and online. And they're going to be rotating the brands on what they're seeing as emerging. And if sales are good, they're going to keep them.
Now,
that's pretty simple.
Marsha, I'm going to kind of butt in here and be a bit contrarian, but I'm not really sure if these guys are a winner. I think these guys, they've obviously come out and brought in something that's innovative, and we love to see that. But I think, as we say in Australia, the proof is in the pudding, right? So I think these guys would be certainly considered a winner once their concept store actually started to achieve what they aim to achieve. But I'm not too sure. Like we see a lot of trends and we report on a lot of trends, but do you think this is going to really translate to success in what you've seen with, say, millennials in the cosmetic space?
I think it will. And one of the big reasons for it is that this is something that's under the Forever 21 umbrella.
Yeah.
They already have a built-in follower base. They already have a tribe of people in this like generation that they're targeting who are shopping for clothes and for their accessories and things like that in Forever 21. They have a mailing list, I'm sure that's like huge for something like this. So once they do launch this and they have those concept stores up, I'm sure that they're going to be able to first of all leverage the market that they already have that's existing from their clothing stores. And also with all the exciting stuff that they're doing on social and making the whole place kind of an Instagram heaven, I think that's going to draw a lot of people in. But as you said, Chris, the proof is in the pudding. So we'll definitely keep our eye on this one. We'll see if the sales actually translate. But I do have a good feeling at this point.
Yeah, perfect. So I've got a couple of things to hold you to. So I've got Kate Hudson, and now I've also got Forever 21 and Riley
Rose. Rihanna as well.
And Rihanna as well. So let's jump across to the losers for this particular episode. So we're going to jump into the losers for this particular episode, and I'll kick us off with GE Appliances. So I mentioned in the introduction for this show, we had Home Depot last week for a lawsuit that they had to pay out, and I've got GE Appliances for a very similar reason. So GE Appliances are obligated to pay out $1.2 million to settle a class action lawsuit stemming from a 2015 fire that destroyed a building at Louisville Appliance Park. Now, this wasn't actually one of their own factories, but rather a factory of one of their suppliers who supplies parts to their appliances. And it kind of makes you question how reliable are the parts that they're putting into their washing machines and tumble dryers, and how much they're ensuring that their suppliers are compliant and further not endangering human life, because that's something at the end of the day that we're all really cognizant of. And from a PR perspective, this is definitely a massive loss for GE Appliances. Now, I kind of wanted to jump across also to another news story that I viewed during the week, and that one is for Vaseline for a very, very similar reason, in the sense that they're also under legal pressure from a California couple who are suing Unilever, who is the parent brand, claiming that one of the partners within the couple suffered third-degree burns on her arm after applying Vaseline and it accidentally catching light. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I've never heard anything with like that – with Vaseline before, and I definitely have used the product. But it kind of begs the question how important it is for brands to be compliant and make sure that their processes and their operations are really up to scratch and are really transparent in how the consumer sees it. I know we touched on lawsuits last week, but they can be a really big PR loss for brands, and it just shows how important it is for brands to make sure that they are on top of their products and their suppliers.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it in past stories as well. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. And who do we have for the loser this week, Marsha?
So the loser that we have this week is Toys R Us, and they've been in the news quite a lot recently, and unfortunately it hasn't been the best news that we've been seeing about them.
Mm.
So what's going on is that they're actually struggling with a $5 billion long-term debt, and they've actually filed for a Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in the U.S. ahead of the key holiday shopping season. That being said, they are planning to continue their normal business operations, but also it's kind of expected that the Canadian subsidiary is going to follow suit with similar news there. So it's really unfortunate. You know, Toys R Us is a store that's been around for a long time, and they really have seen quite a lot of success. But, you know, with competitors like Amazon out there, I can imagine that it's very hard to stay afloat. Something else that happened with Toys R Us that I think is worth noting is that at the end of 2015, they actually shut down their superstore in Times Square. So for our listeners in New York, you're probably familiar with the store. You must have gone in there with your kids. So the store had an 18-meter indoor Ferris wheel. They had a growling 6-meter realistic-looking Tyrannosaurus Rex. And they also had a life-size Barbie dollhouse. And it was so popular with kids. And unfortunately, the rent was just too high, and they had to close their doors. So, you know, this happened at the end of 2015, and this and other pieces of news with Toys R Us have just been leading them to this $5 billion long-term debt.
Yeah, definitely. It's a shame to see one of North America's great big box retailers succumb to the new age of Amazon, I guess, as it's been dubbed. So,
Chris, do you think there was anything that they could be doing to kind of, you know, save themselves and to stay afloat? You know, we've seen example with Macy's and with other department stores trying new store concepts, trying, you know, like mini stores and doing some more engaging things with their social and with their marketing. Do you think there's anything that Toys R Us could do, or is Amazon just going to kill them?
It's funny, Marsha, because, you know, we always read about the doom and gloom of retail and all, you know, all the popular literature out there at the moment says, why aren't the retailers doing more? Why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? But when you're an organization that's been around for so long and you know, an organization where a lot of people have built their careers over a 30 or 40 year span, these organizations are not built for change. They're not built for adaptability. They dominated in a space that was relevant 20 or 30 years ago, but they're still playing as if they're in that space. But it's not easy for them to quickly and rapidly just shift their focus and suddenly become this, you know, this multinational supply chain giant that retails through online that has a perfectly aligned omnichannel strategy, right? Can they do anything to rescue themselves? I'm not too sure. That's like why I guess I'm not the CEO of Sears or Macy's, but I think it's a lot deeper than what people think, and it's a lot harder for these organizations to adapt and really make a meaningful change.
I agree. I think, you know what, I think they'll be able to do small things here and there and, you know, maybe potentially be able to stay afloat. But in the long term, unfortunately, I don't see them turning into a winner on our podcast anytime soon.
I'd love to see it, though. Yeah. Hopefully Toys R Us, the challenge is set. Go out there and be one of our winners in the next few weeks or the next few, episodes. Okay, so we're continuing to push on, and we're onto the section that's probably one of my favorite, to be honest, which is the retail roadmap, where we get to take a little bit more of an in-depth look at where retail is going in the future. So what I want to talk about today is the connected warehouse and robotics and the Internet of Things in warehousing and supply chain management today. So once upon a time there were operations or internal warehouse operations were managed with manual processes and manual calculations. And I've been a part of this in my previous life and actually seen these operations function, and it's an understatement to say that they operate inefficiently, But I guess that was the constraints of the technology that was available at the time. But volume, which will only increase, and the complexity of supply chain management and operations means that a more sophisticated approach is necessary. So predictive analytics and machine learning are now just as valuable variations as fuel costs were in the past, where somebody used to sit there manually and crunch the numbers. And if you think about the concept of just in time, it's almost becoming more and more efficient as organizations are able to get more predictive on what is required from their warehouses at a particular point in time. One thing I wanted to talk about is Amazon. And we always talk about Amazon, but they're spoken about for a particular reason. And that's because...
Yeah, how can you not, right?
Yeah, because they're leaders within their particular space. And Amazon uses an organization called Kiva and Kiva Robots, an organization that they purchased in 2012 for $775 million to manage their inventory within their warehouses. Now, I'll include it on the show notes, but there's a video of showing how these Kiva robots work, and it is nothing short of amazing to see these robots just steaming through a warehouse and picking up the shelves and the stock that they need to, bringing it to the supply chain person and pushing it through so it's actually fulfilled. And it begs the question of what does this mean for brands and what is going to happen in the future for brands, where drop shipping is going to become much, much more relevant. Pardon me. So, Marsha, I'm not too sure if you're familiar with the concept of drop shipping, but drop shipping is basically cuts out the middleman. So,
yeah, I am quite familiar with that.
Yeah, so it means, for those who don't know what it means basically sending your inventory straight to your end consumer as opposed to going through your retailer. Now, the repercussions for brands are how they're going to actually adapt to this sort of change and how they're going to make their own warehouses more efficient. Their old end consumer was always the retailer, and it was a fairly simplistic process. But when your orders are being fulfilled in multiple different spots, say across North America or even across the world, it becomes a really unique challenge. And it begs the question of how much robotics are required and how necessary is data in this entire process. I don't know. What's your opinion on it, Marsha?
So, I think there's a lot of different ways to collect data from things like this, and we're going to be seeing more and more of it. It's also a way just for retail to become so much more efficient. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of shy away from robotics, and, you know, they think it's going to take away jobs from humans, but I really do think there's a balance, and I think this if this helps retailers, it is going to create more jobs in the long run.
Yeah, and definitely. And then there's another organization called Locus, and they also have a clip of what their product does on YouTube, so I strongly encourage everybody to go out and have a look at it. But they're big promoters of the fact that they're not trying to make workers redundant, but rather make the warehouse a lot more efficient. And they make a fair point in saying that when you have a robot, you don't have to pay it salary, you don't have to pay it for lunch, you don't have to pay it for everything that you are with a human worker, but also it's a physical thing, right? One of the pieces of information I found that was that workers are walking anywhere between 14 to 16 miles a day on a factory or a warehouse floor. So to reduce that is also reducing the strain on humans, which is only a positive thing and makes us use our resources where they can be more valuable.
So lastly, we're going to jump into the data dive. And here we're going to showcase a company that's using data effectively in retail and what they're using it for. So something that I'm really fascinated with, and I'm sure you are as well, Chris, is the use of beacons in retail. And the company that I want to speak about on this episode is Target. So they're finding a really innovative and interesting way to use beacons. So what they're doing is they're using Bluetooth beacon-enabled mapping features on their own mobile app to help customers find their way inside Target stores. So the way that this works is that the beacons are built into the LED lighting of the stores, and they're enabling Target shoppers to use the smartphone app on their phone to see their own position in the store on a store map. And as customers move through the store, their position on the map changes correspondingly to where they are. And what's more interesting, though, is that as they're using this, they can click on products on their shopping list to reveal the exact location of that item and see if it's on sale. So I'm sure that the amount of data that's being collected with something like this is it just must be astounding for a target. They're able to see the kind of path that people take. If something isn't making sense, like if they're seeing that something isn't really optimized, they can move things around. And they could see, you know, what's working and what's not in terms of these sales items and if it's enticing enough for people to go there. It's also similar to other beaconing technology like triggered coupons, but that has actually proven unpopular with customers. I think it's because some people see it as almost, you know, invasive. If they're just driving somewhere and they have no intention of shopping and they're passing a Target store or wherever it may be, and then some kind of coupon or something pops up on their phone, yeah. You know, they're not the biggest fan of that.
Yeah.
So I do like what Target is doing with this. I think it's a good balance. You know, if the customer is already in the store, obviously they're shopping and they are receptive to these types of offers. So I think it's really great, and they are going to be able to gather some really interesting data with that. So the store that came to mind for me was something like this. I think IKEA would be really great. I mean, IKEA is so confusing.
Yeah, to walk yeah, around. That's
it's
a maze.
It's giant. So I think something like this would be incredible.
I was in IKEA probably, it was probably maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and I literally was lost for 15 minutes in there.
Yeah, it happens every time. So if anybody from IKEA is listening, Beacon Technology, you guys should try it out.
That's the way to go.
But Chris, I do have a question for you here. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that Target's use of beacons is effectively going to help to meet a customer need? Is it going to improve the shopping experience in the store? Do you think it's a good tech investment that Target is making?
It's funny, Marsha. Like we feature a lot of stuff on the retail roadmap and the data dive that really looks at technology and innovation and how retailers are leveraging that to try and get a competitive advantage. But as you're telling me this story, I'm trying to think of the average Target consumer, and are they likely, you think, to go into their smartphone and log in and then kind of find their way around the store? Does the average Target consumer even use a smartphone? I'm sure they probably do, but how excessively do they use it? And how relevant is this sort of innovation in that sense? For brands, obviously this looks really exciting, and it looks really exciting in a news article, but how practical is it actually being used in store? I've thrown the question back on you.
That's a really good point, you know. So actually, you know, Target, and just this past February, they announced their plans to spend $7 billion in store, digital, and supply chain related expenditures over the next 3 years. Mm. But that is a really good point that you bring up. I'm sure that a lot of research went into, you know, how they're going to be spending these $7 billion. And I'm sure they've done a lot of research on their customer base and who does use this type of technology.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I could see this kind of skewing a little bit younger. The people who would be using this.
Exactly.
Maybe an older generation still would be, you know, they want to go the old-fashioned way and they want to just speak to an associate in store and ask them where something is.
Organizations like Sephora, who we constantly feature, this is probably super relevant for an organization such as them, whose target market is completely different. But yeah, look, the actual end consumer of Target, I'm not exactly 100% sure who it is, and you might be able to shed a little bit of light on that, but I'm not too sure how relevant some of this stuff might actually be and how likely somebody is to pull out their phone and see where they are in store. For IKEA, I think it's perfect. I think it's super relevant because the place is like a cave. It's like a...
it's a maze. You know, it's definitely a maze.
Exactly right. But somewhere like Target, I'm not too sure.
Yeah, I guess we'll keep an eye on it and we'll see if it's a worthwhile investment or if it's something that they're gonna regret a little bit.
What's great about this is we've got a lot of fodder for our winners and losers in the coming weeks and months. So it'll be really exciting to see how this shakes out. Alrighty, so we've come to the end of another episode of Retail Ramblings. Just want to review quickly what we've touched on today. So our winners were Henkel and Riley Rose. Henkel for the Raf Cycle Awards and Riley Rose as a new retail store in the cosmetic space, which will be really interesting to keep an eye on. Our losers were GE Appliances and a fairly obvious one in Toys R Us. On the retail roadmap side of things, we had a look at robotics and the Internet of Things in warehousing and supply chain management. And the data dive, which we've just gone through, we had a look at Target and Beacon Technology. So as usual, look out for our next episode. Put us or send us a review on iTunes. Send us some feedback. Tell us how we can improve. Tell us what we can do better. And hopefully we can bring that on and bring it in with our next few episodes. But other than that, thanks for listening.